Good evening, everyone.
Welcome to the LSE and to this event. I'm Craig Calhoun, the director of the LSE, and we're just discussing whether you should say it's a pleasure to introduce something which is a discussion of bad things happening in the world. But it is a pleasure because we have two very distinguished speakers to talk about some very important issues. Peter Gill is the author of Today We Drop Bombs, Tomorrow We Build Bridges, a book that is about to be published, addressing the increasing entanglement of humanitarian action in a world of security and military concerns, and the ways in which this affects and changes what goes on for humanitarian organizations, and the different ways in which they respond and position themselves in this world. Peter's a journalist who has specialized in developing world affairs. He's been the South Asia and Middle East correspondent for the Daily Telegraph. He's traveled and worked widely in Africa and Asia, and he's been a current affairs reporter for ITV, the BBC. He covered the fall of Saigon for the Daily Telegraph, and he's made documentary films on Afghanistan during the Soviet occupation. Afghanistan is one of the sort of central points for thinking about this issue of the militarization, securitization of humanitarian assistance. Peter's also led major media campaigns to combat AIDS and leprosy in India, working with the BBC, and he's written four other books on a variety of development themes, including a study of Oxfam's early work and two books on the politics of hunger in Ethiopia. As a respondent to Peter, we have Michael Kaufman. Michael is the senior humanitarian specialist for the humanitarian innovation team of Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders. Michael joined MSF in 1993 and has worked as a country director in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Bosnia, Burundi, Sri Lanka, Brazil, South Sudan, Kosovo, Chechnya, and Afghanistan. And he's currently based in Belfast. Peter will speak for about half an hour, introducing a core set of themes, not just the book as a whole, but a particular talk. Michael will respond. We'll see if they have questions for each other right at the end, and then open this to you for your questions and comments. When you speak, let me remind you to say who you are and try to speak reasonably briefly. You don't each have half an hour on this occasion. The hashtag for the event, if you use Twitter, is #LSEconflict. With nothing further, Peter, let me introduce you.
Good evening. It's very good to be here. My thanks are due first to Professor Calhoun for chairing this, for agreeing to chair this evening's lecture, and for that introduction. I also want to thank Stuart Gordon for inviting me here in the first place and for his help earlier on in the book. Thanks also to Sarah Carter from the International Development Department and the events team for putting this all together. I should also say that we are in for some really important insights this evening from Michael Hoffman from Médecins Sans Frontières. I've had a number of extremely enlightening conversations with him for this book, just as some of my most vivid experiences in the field in researching this book have been with the agency that Michael represents. In a month's time, in Istanbul, the United Nations is going to stage its first ever World Humanitarian Summit. It couldn't be happening in a more important place. That's a city and a country on the edge of the Syrian catastrophe, and it couldn't be happening at a more important time. 125 million people around the world are currently in need of humanitarian assistance. That's the population equivalent of the 10th biggest country in the world. 60 million people, we know, have fled their homes around the world. That's close to the population of the United Kingdom. The key thing about this summit is that it's not a member state initiative, It's the UN itself which is promoting it. There's no draft UN resolution floating around, and no agreed text will emerge at the end. At most, there will be a report back to the UN General Assembly in September, and then maybe, just maybe, an agreed resolution will emerge sometime after that. The world, meanwhile, will burn. With just 4 weeks to go, it's not at all clear even who will show up. Obama almost certainly won't, but Joe Biden may. Angela Merkel is expected, and that may oblige other big Europeans to make their appearance. You can expect argumentative delegations, but no top leadership from countries rather out of step with this whole process. Russia, China, Egypt, Venezuela, Cuba. So why bother with this summit at all? The best answer so far to that question has been provided by the UN itself and the advance report that it's prepared for the conference. It's called One Humanity, Shared Responsibility. And by UN standards, I'm no expert on UN documentation, but by UN standards, it is a very vivid and ambitious document. Released from the need to defer to a divided and paralyzed Security Council, the report's authors have set out to tell the world some humanitarian home truths. It begins, sharply enough, with the story of a six-year-old boy forced to flee from his village with only what he could carry in his arms. The schools had been destroyed, his home was abandoned, and the little boy was filled with fear and uncertainty, says the report. This was early on in the Korean War, and the boy, of course, was Ban Ki-moon, now Secretary General of the United Nations. The One Humanity report has gone out in Ban Ki-moon's name. It may well reflect his personal frustration at having presided over the world body for the past decade. This has been a time when the humanitarian imperative was trumpeted by politicians all around the world, and when humanitarian practice and principles were being simultaneously undermined and trashed. The starting point for the report is the UN Charter and the responsibility of member states to prevent and to end conflicts, and then to build peace. Yet, it says, this is the quote, "This effort is not where our political leadership or resources are presently focused. In today's conflicts," and I'm still quoting, "often it seems to be easier for the international community to invest in humanitarian responses than in concerted efforts to prevent and resolve conflicts. When national politicians do act," it goes on, "their leadership is too often," I'm quoting, "too often only triggered by immediate, narrowly defined national security and economic interests, and only once a situation has deteriorated." Then the report turns to abuses of international humanitarian law, the UN speaking, and the lack of respect for fundamental humanitarian principles. Its vision here is apocalyptic. The brazen and brutal conduct of contemporary conflict threatens to unravel 150 years of progress and to regress, this is the quote, "to an era of war without limits." Those 150 years take us back to the early 1860s, when the aftermath of a single ferocious battle between the French and the Austrians at a place called Solferino inspired, in short order, the establishment in Geneva of the International Committee of the Red Cross and the signing of the first Geneva Convention. This is the creation story of modern institutionalized humanitarianism, what its own practitioners like to call these days the aid industry. The UN report also charts the road to Istanbul, the 3-year global consultation that has gone into shaping the summit. Here, it's the big Western aid givers who come in for criticism. National governments and local organizations in the world's conflict zones complain that they're simply pushed aside by big aid, that major Western donors and their charity partners are, this is the quote, uncommitted to working collaboratively and too dominated by the interests and funding of a few countries. Syria is the standout case here. With very few exceptions, it's Syrians themselves who are doing the frontline aid work. Even the most determined of the overseas agencies, Médecins Sans Frontières, for example, have been driven out of Islamic State areas and, for the most part, can work only remotely, that is, through assisting local Syrian health facilities in other parts of the country. When I was on the Turkey-Syria border, I focused on the exceptional achievements of a new generation of aid givers, the Syrian diaspora organizations, which cross and recross the border to bring help to their fellow countrymen. There were British Syrian groups, French Syrian groups, American Syrian groups. I met up with the smiling figure of Dr. Munir Hakimi, originally from Homs, now an orthopedic surgeon in Greater Manchester. He's one of the founders of a Manchester NGO called Syria Relief, which started up within months of the outbreak of the civil war back in 2011. When I met him, Dr. Hakimi had already done his week's work at the Royal Bolton Hospital. That, he assured me, was mostly hip and knee replacements for the elderly of the northwest of England. Then on Friday, he flew to eastern Turkey, where I was able to meet him. So on his weekend off from Bolton, he crossed into Syria, and his plan was to use the time to catch up on management jobs, administrative jobs, at his charity hospital near the border. It didn't turn out quite like that at all. There was a Syrian air raid that Saturday morning in a nearby town, and he spent all of that day and a good deal of the next in the operating theatre. The exceptional role of Syrian aid workers has been recognised by those best qualified to judge. With the honesty that MSF customarily brings to its analysis, it was one of their own senior people who reported that Syrian diaspora medical groups had, here's the quote, certainly contributed much more to increasing access to medical services than all the MSF sections combined. What these small Syrian groups do not have is money, or rather the money that overseas Syrians could generously afford to donate in the early months of the conflict, back in 2011 and 2012, has long since run out. They now depend on the big international NGOs to fund them. Save the Children, for instance, is a major funder on the Turkish-Syrian border. Behind Save the Children and the other big INGOs is often the British government. They are, and I use the word that British officials have used to me, they are the wholesaler here, with the international NGOs, INGOs, acting as their retailers. So it's Syrian aid organizations out there on the front line, but they are at the end of a very long financial chain. And I found them frustrated that their expertise, the centrality of their role, goes unrecognized. They complain that the big funders, governments and charities, are not responsive enough to local needs, inflexible on aid priorities, and desperately, unrealistically anxious that not a penny, should ever go astray in the middle of what is a terrible and chaotic war. The Western bureaucrats' terror of inadvertently helping someone on the wrong side is hampering the effective delivery of foreign aid, and part of that gap, is being filled by more robust new players, such as those from the Gulf. This mismatch in expectations will certainly be raised, perhaps even addressed, in Istanbul. All the risks of getting aid through to Syria are being outsourced to Syrians, but none of the trust you would expect to accompany those risks. And I can add one more chilling statistic to all those other Syrian statistics that we try to absorb on a daily basis. Since the war began 5 years ago, the International Committee of the Red Cross has kept a careful casualty record on behalf of its local partners, the Syrian Arab Red Crescent, SARC. To date, 53 staff and volunteers from SARC have been killed as they went about their humanitarian duties. As we're so often reminded in this country, Britain plays a very significant role in the field of aid and development. We are major aid givers, and we also credit ourselves with being major aid thinkers. We may have lost that empire, I often think, but Britain has finally found its role in its aid programme. The British emphasis on aid dates, a bit more history here, back to New Labour's arrival in power in 1997. At that point, the aid budget was removed from the Foreign Office and a new independent Department for International Development, DFID, was created. Its focus would cease to be on the promotion of Britain's commercial interests abroad. That had been the old conservative way, but exclusively on the elimination of world poverty. That's what happened over the next few years until the world changed again at 9/11 and the war on terror got underway. Winning that war with the help of the aid budget became the new priority. New Labour ministers were soon speaking of bringing security to the heart of DFID's mission. And by the time they lost office in 2010, they were committed to spending half the bilateral aid budget on fragile and conflict-affected states. Until 2002, for instance, neither Iraq nor Afghanistan figured anywhere among Britain's top 20 aid recipients. 2 years later, Iraq was right at the top of the list, and 2 years after that, Afghanistan had been promoted to the top three. When the Conservative Lib Dem coalition came to power in 2010, an internal DFID paper spoke of how development projects would be expected to make the maximum possible contribution to Britain's national security. Now that the Conservatives are running the country on their own, the rhetoric around aid has sharpened still further, and the link to security at home has become even more explicit. Half the entire aid budget, which we need to remind ourselves is both ring-fenced and rising, half of that aid budget is now committed to tackling insecurity. And David Cameron speaks of making our spending an even more fundamental part of our strategy to keep our country safe. If you doubt Britain's discovery of its post-imperial role, just listen further to the Prime Minister. The aid programme, he says, will help maintain Britain's position as number one in the world for soft power. And in my favourite quote for this evening, Cameron goes on, "Yes, it may be called soft power, but I can tell you, that soft power packs a real punch." There's a less reputable side to current conservative rhetoric around aid. It's connected to Britain's miserly response to taking its fair share of the refugees from Syria and the other war on terror countries. As the tide of refugees rose in the Mediterranean, we agreed to take only those 20,000 over 5 years, just 4,000 a year until 2020. Mr. Cameron commits more and more aid to the Middle East crisis and pitches it like this to a sceptical domestic audience. The aid will be spent, he says, on stabilizing and supporting broken and fragile states and do much more to help refugees nearer their homes, closer to their homes. You get the point. That's been the issue this week, you will have noticed, in the tussle between the House of Commons and the House of Lords. The government has conceded that we should take additional vulnerable children from the camps, but has set its face, and they won their vote on Monday night, and they may get another chance to vote differently, but not yet. The government has set its face against helping any unaccompanied refugee child who's reached Europe, whatever dangers he or she faces. It should come as no surprise to anyone at the end of the day that a national aid programme like Britain's is going to have Britain's narrowly defined national interest at its core. That is what governments do, and that is how they get elected. The question arises, whose responsibility is it to ensure that British and other aid actually gets to where it's most needed and to all those who need it? The answer, surely, is that aid workers themselves have a major responsibility here. The way they discharge that duty goes to the very heart of the European humanitarian tradition. The nature of the job means that humanitarian aid workers necessarily have, throughout the existence of this institutionalized humanitarianism, necessarily live by crisis, crisis after crisis, ethical crisis as well as political crisis. But the collapse of states now and the war on terror of the present era pose some of the gravest challenges they've ever faced. Usefully, in two sentences, the UN summit document provides us with an essential framework for this discussion. Now, at this point, there may, if I press the right button, Stuart, a mouse, that's what I need. Which side would you suggest I... I was told that there would be a wonderful click, but then I'm not the person to... There would be a wonderful click, and that quote would... It's worth having.
Yeah, sorry.
There's just one slide that we actually is there somewhere, but we didn't actually check.
Is that it?
It's just an extensive textual quote, which I think would be useful to have up on screen. That's the one. That's the one. If that's nice and big, yeah, that's big enough.
Okay.
That's fantastic. Thank you. This is actually, if you have a look at that report, paragraph 55. This is very impressive, Stuart. We're there. Brilliant. The humanitarian principles: humanity, impartiality, neutrality, and independence are central to obtaining access to populations in need. Ensuring that all humanitarian assistance is impartial, neutral, and independent from military interventions or political agendas is critical for humanitarian organizations to earn trust and acceptance among state and non-state armed groups and to gain and maintain access and operate in safety. The country and the conflict that have tested these principles to destruction is Afghanistan. Western aid agencies have been on the ground there in total for some 35 years now, from the time they first gained access through Mujahideen guerrillas fighting the Russians in the 1980s, to the time when some of them managed to work quite successfully with the Taliban regime of the late 1990s, right the way through to the modern era, where everyone in the aid world piled in to Afghanistan during the American war. For 13 years, Afghanistan was where Western governments paid for ground troops, warplanes, and aid workers in the same theater at the same time. This was where George W. Bush dropped ration packs along with bombs, so, as he put it, the oppressed people of Afghanistan of Afghanistan know the generosity of America and our allies. This was where Tony Blair spoke of building a humanitarian coalition alongside the military coalition. This, most extraordinary of all, was where Colin Powell, as US Secretary of State at the time of 9/11, praised the NGOs for being such a force multiplier for us, such an important part of our combat team. In the early years of the Afghan War, most of those NGOs were actually quite untroubled by their association with, however indirect, however direct, their association with the Western military. In the post-Taliban era, I think Bakil was actually in Afghanistan, in that, certainly in the first decade of this century, quite untroubled by their... In that post-Taliban era, there was all the excitement of a new beginning in Afghanistan, and an apparent identity of purpose shared by the aid worker, the diplomat, the politician, and the soldier. If anything, aid workers actually wanted more, not less, military action. In 2003, no fewer than 85 overseas NGOs based in Kabul put their signatures to an appeal to NATO called a call for security. It was, in fact, a call to arms. It urged the international military to extend its operations to key locations and major transport routes outside Kabul so that, this is the NGOs speaking, democracy can flourish and improve the prospect for peace and stability for the Afghan people and the world. There were several notable names which did not sign up to this call to arms, because they never do, or almost never. Theirs is a more thoroughgoing commitment to impartiality and neutrality. First, there was the International Committee of the Red Cross, guardians of the Geneva Conventions and codifiers of the fundamental principles. They were not signing. They never do. Second, MSF itself, which began life as a French breakaway from the ICRC in the early 1970s, and whose commitment to the Red Cross principles is the basis of their charter and quite explicit. This division between those who formally subscribe to Red Cross principles and those who do not has taken on much more definition during the War on Terror. When it comes down to it, it's a divide between the Francophone and the Anglophone world. On the one hand, there are those in the direct line of descent from the original Red Cross. On the other, there are those American and British aid agencies which, for different reasons and at different times, have grown closer and closer to their own governments. When in doubt, as the old journalistic maxim goes, you follow the money. The ICRC is largely funded by governments. Its biggest funder, by far, is the United States itself. But its guardianship of the Geneva Conventions provides it with its own guarantee of independence. MSF has grown into an international enterprise with an annual income of well over €1 billion. But almost all of it is raised from private sources, Less than 10% comes from governments and other public institutions. It takes no money at all from belligerents in conflict zones, no funds from the US government, and it gets nothing, as a matter of interest, from the French government either. Contrast that with the two biggest British aid agencies, Oxfam and Save the Children. Oxfam's income last year was a bit over £400 million. Nearly half of that came from governments and other official bodies, which was pretty well twice what it raised from private donations and legacies. £46 million alone came from the British government. The story at Save the Children is actually much more dramatic. 60% of its income now comes from governments and other official bodies. Under its recently departed CEO, Justin Forsyth, ex-Oxfam, ex-Downing Street, Save the Children has earned the tag, I don't know whether one envies them or not, contractor of choice to the British government. Over 5 years, that's 2010 to 2015, Save the Children increased its earnings from the British government alone six times over, $19 million in 2010, $120 million in 2015. The British agencies see themselves, it's fair to underline, as multi-mandated because their role extends beyond emergency relief into service delivery and a range of other development initiatives. But there is a risk here. At the further reaches of this development spectrum, there is governance work, democracy training, the openly political agenda of nation building. On occasions, even the most reputable American and British agencies have come perilously close to being Colin Powell's force multipliers. In Afghanistan, these distinctions are actually played out on the ground. It was thanks to MSF, keep coming back to them, that I flew on a Red Cross plane, as a matter of fact, into Lashkargah, the main town in Helmand, just as American and British troops were staging their final withdrawal. That pullout means that the only foreigners left in Helmand at present are frontline humanitarians from just three organisations. First, there are ICRC delegates with their Afghan staff. Second, there's a big MSF team running the main provincial hospital. When I was there, as a matter of interest, the majority of that team was African, with their own unique African experience of countries in turmoil. There were MSF staff from Democratic Republic of Congo, from Congo Brazzaville, from South Sudan, from Zimbabwe. They knew, I think, what the world was about. Third, of the agencies still represented by international staff in Helmand are the trauma specialists working for a remarkable Italian charity called Emergency. There were, at the time of my visit, other Western agencies with a presence, a substantial and impressive presence in some ways in Helmand, but their staff were wholly Afghan, not international. The US agency Mercy Corps was running vocational training courses in Lashkargah. Islamic Relief, British in origin, now international in character, was promoting primary school enrollment. In the neighbouring province of Oruzgan, Save the Children has an ambitious health and education programme. But many of the big Western agencies are actually not represented at all, even those substantially present in Afghanistan, are not represented at all in any of the most challenging southern provinces of that country. Of course, professions of neutrality provide no guarantee of safety in the modern aid world. 2014 figures show Afghanistan still to be the most dangerous place on earth for aid workers. 54 major attacks that year, compared with 26 in Syria. The 2015 figures, when confirmed, will almost certainly be worse. They will include 5 Save the Children staff murdered by the Taliban in Oruzgan last March, and the 13 hospital staff that MSF lost when their trauma hospital in Kunduz was repeatedly struck by a United States gunship last October. Yet the bravest and the best of these agencies still stick it out on the front line. And when they are forced out, they keep talking and they keep looking for a way to get back in. Sometimes it's the length of experience and familiarity with people and places that reassure them. From what I saw on my researches, the adoption of clear-cut humanitarian principles provided them with an even greater sense of moral self-confidence in the field. The focus next month at the World Humanitarian Summit and over the months to come will be on what the United Nations itself can do at this time of humanitarian crisis. Will the fine sentiments behind the Secretary-General's report add up to anything at all? Will there be any sort of formal commitment to those humanitarian principles as the agenda formally proposes? On the face of it, the prospects are unpromising. The UN itself is now part of the problem. So-called One UN initiatives have subordinated the UN's own humanitarian agencies to the cause of winning the war on terror. An integrated UN mission in a country like Somalia means that support for a shaky government ultimately has to take priority over its duty of care towards civilians. The UN may still talk gamely about observing fundamental humanitarian principles, but in Somalia, they're the ones deploying African Union troops to fight the jihadists and insisting at the same time that UNICEF, the World Food Programme, and the refugee agency UNHCR put on their body armour, join the convoy, and follow the blue flag. Going back 20 years, the last great shock to global humanitarian pretensions, even to the notions of an improving world, was delivered by the massacres of Rwanda and Srebrenica in the mid-1990s. It led, under the last UN Secretary-General Kofi Annan, to the establishment of a grand international commission and to a fine-sounding new doctrine, the responsibility to protect. This held that sovereign states have a responsibility to protect their citizens from avoidable catastrophe, and that when they fail, responsibility has to be borne by the international community. Responsibility to protect earned its own World Summit in 2005. It established its own international bureaucracy. It even coined its own little mnemonic, R2P. And we've heard very little of it since, nor can I see any reference to it in the documentation at this new summit. The problem, of course, with Kofi Annan's initiative was its wretched timing. His international commission reported back to him in September 2001, just 2 weeks after 9/11. By then, the window had closed on the ethnic atrocities of the old century, and a new window had opened on the misjudgments, the excesses, and the horrors of the war on terror. This has culminated so far in the rise of Islamic State and the depravity of the Syrian civil war. Responsibility to protect has so far proved to be a sham. In these circumstances, the only hope for the Istanbul summit may lie in its non-state composition. It's intended to be as much a civil society as a governmental exercise. Can we, the people, reckon to exercise any real influence over the world body and all the vested national interests tied up in the humanitarian aid system? We should, I'm sure, try and keep the faith And if the outcome is disappointing at the level of international governance, we can at least keep our faith in the best of the aid agencies, those who do not depend overly on government patronage to do their job, those that do subscribe to fundamental humanitarian principles and actually mean it. Thank you very much.
Michael Hoffman now.
Wow, that's quite an exposé, Peter. And quite interesting that you hang it up to a speech or a document written by Ban Ki-moon, and starting off with his own life story, because actually quite recently in the ongoing debates of how it becomes more and more difficult to have independent humanitarian aid, we were confronted with the bizarre fact that by to the end of 2015, beginning of 2016, 4 out of 5 permanent members of the Security Council were actively bombing in Syria. So you had the situation where Security Council passed resolutions about protections of civilians, whilst the actual veto-wielding members themselves were active in this conflict. And we wrote a report about that, and then initially we said for the first time in history this had happened, and then we realized actually, no, this is the second time in history this happened. The other time was the time when Ban Ki-moon, as a 6-year-old boy, fled Korea, which was the other occasion where 4 out of 5 of the permanent members of the Security Council were actively engaged in the conflict. And that is, of course, one of the biggest problems that you highlight in your exposé. But there's a few things that I might want to sharpen a bit from what you've said. You started by kind of agreeing with the Ban Ki-moon's statement, how the world should be looking at an end to conflict and not using humanitarianism as a substitute. And that has become one of the pervasive themes, in fact, in the discussions in the World Humanitarian Summit, which they call the bridging the divide between the development and the humanitarian. And that is something that I really oppose, because humanitarianism in its pure form is by definition reactive. It responds to a disaster, and one of the most complicated disasters that it responds to is conflict. And to somehow assume that humanitarianism should contribute to the causes of this disaster actually makes it less independent and less able to react as a result. And for me, it's as absurd as, because the other types of disasters that humanitarians react to are earthquakes, for instance. Nobody is suggesting that the humanitarian agencies should also contribute to ending the phenomena of earthquakes. Yet with conflicts, somehow that is put in the back of the humanitarians to also solve, on top of the obligation of actually reacting to the victims of it rather than the root causes. So I would not subscribe to that. But it is true, of course, what he said in his speech, that in recent years, I don't think it's so much the nature of the conflict. Conflicts have always been quite violent and brutal, and historically, I think conflicts have not really taken humanity or assistance that much into to account. But there is a specific event, indeed, as you said, 150 years ago, which led to the institutional concept of humanitarian aid, and that is definitely being eroded in very, very quickly at the moment, although I doubt if that is something that is either going to be addressed or certainly not resolved in the World Humanitarian Summit, because it's a bit on the sidelines. But it should be on the main lines of those that continuously pledge to uphold it, which is, for instance, this Security Council. Now, Syria is, of course, the example that people use to promote this whole concept that local is good. And the whole concept that the international aid machine is pushing away all those wonderful local initiatives that would be perfectly capable of dealing with it if they just got some money. Which is certainly true in Syria. Syria is a very exceptional conflict in its brutality and very exceptional in terms of its political engagement of almost all the major regional and global powers that are either passively or actively participating in this in this conflict. It's also exceptional in the sense that the Syria had a quite a large diaspora and a very successful diaspora, which allowed both financially and in terms of capacity and knowledge, a very rapid local or diaspora response to replace, in fact, the inability of the traditional aid agencies, including MSF, to respond. But this is certainly not the case in a place like South Sudan or Central Africa. There is no equivalent of a thriving civil society either in the country or a successful diaspora that is able to mobilize to the extent of Syria. And even closer by, Syria, people think, is the biggest conflict with the largest amount of victims in the Middle East, but actually it's quite on par with Yemen at the moment. A similar amount of people that is being affected there, except that they are a bit unlucky in the fact that they are kind of sea-locked. So you don't have hundreds of thousands of Yemenis fleeing across the Arabian Peninsula to Turkey or across the sea to Somalia, actually, is on the other side. And also there you don't have the similar situation. So by and large, the international response or the traditional aid system is delivering the majority of the aid in this in these places. There's a few other countries where this diaspora effect is very strong. Somalia, for instance, is another place where a diaspora, a very successful diaspora with a lot of financial and technical capacity, has been able to substitute and replace the inability of traditional aid agencies to operate there. There is a downside to this model because these agencies, these local agencies, they are missing one essential part of what is a very crucial part of an international aid response, and that is the capacity to be truly impartial, because many of these aid agencies are working on within communities and within a political reality that that often dictates who they can and cannot help. So who actually has access to these health services is often not based on need, but based on ethnic, religious, or political affiliations, which is all equally valid on the other side. You mentioned the Syrian Arab Red Crescent, which is actually doing a lot and is achieving a lot, but they are, of course, mostly connected to the government side, as most of these diaspora organizations are more connected to the opposition side. So although the volume of activities is impressive, there is certainly people that fall through the cracks because their loyalties lie with neither one or the other. So there is a price to pay for this type of localized response. A key point that you made is, of course, the introduction of the concept of the war on terror post 2001. Which has been extremely detrimental for the ability of humanitarians to provide and for the ability of people that need to receive humanitarian aid. It's, of course, a ridiculous concept. Terror is actually an emotion, so you can never win a war on an emotion. So it's something that you can assume will be perpetual, but it was... following that, there has been some real-life developments on legislation, both local and international, that actually penalizes to an extent the provision of humanitarian assistance to what governments regard as their enemies. So there is not a country in the world that hasn't introduced anti-terror legislation, and usually whichever armed opposition is fighting that government is then being designated as terrorist by that government, and having any kind of dealings with them, including providing humanitarian assistance to populations they control, by and large made illegal. You see that very strong in Syria. You saw it very strong in Somalia. And even if aid agencies are not explicitly told that they're not allowed to do it, there is a certain chill factor, as it's called in the literature, that aid agencies are very reluctant to deal with armed groups that are on an anti-terror list. And in the recent years, actually, we've seen it being used as an excuse to actually directly attack aid structures. It's no secret that MSF in the last few years has seen an exponential rise in the number of hospitals that has been bombed and attacked. For actual MSF structures alone, I think it's something like 12 or 14 in the past 2 years. If you add MSF-supported structures, it's closer to 90. And most of these bombings, because rebel groups tend not to have air forces, are actually states that are bombing those hospitals. The most obvious and high-profile example being, of course, the United States bombing of the hospital in Kunduz. But the coalition formed by Saudi Arabia in Yemen has been doing it. The Syrian government has been doing it. The variety of coalitions active over Syria have been doing it. And by and large, although publicly it's usually portrayed as a mistake or collateral damage, between when you go into the bilateral discussions with those responsible, it is usually not portrayed as that, but they say, we attacked you because you were harboring terrorists in your hospital. And the terrorists they refer to were actually patients. This is a very core principle of international humanitarian law, that any kind of combatant that is wounded actually becomes a patient and becomes protected under international humanitarian law. This is one aspect that is very blatantly being challenged now by the same states that have actually signed those conventions back in 1948. And if that continues, this erosion, then and your humanitarian assistance, whether it's a hospital, whether it's a feeding center, whether it's a school, is being seen as a legitimate target by both state and non-state forces because your assistance might possibly help what the governments call a terrorist, then, of course, it would be game over for the whole concept of providing aid. What I found very interesting was your exposé on the development of the policy of DFID over the consecutive governments, where indeed security and national interest is becoming very explicit as one of the objectives of the foreign aid. Maybe to add to that, there was a recent decision, I think it was by the OESC, which allowed countries, because there's a kind of an agreement of 0.7% of gross national income should be spent on aid, to actually include their military budgets in this 0.7%. So if there is any kind of a helicopter, navy ship, or anything that is being seen as contributing to the aid effort, then this can be added to the budget. So it's also in clear monetary terms, the aid and security is actually now combined in the budget. It's more than just a speech. It's actually a spreadsheet now in the Office of the Accountants of not just the United Kingdom, but of a majority of the European and Western governments. And of course, you're right that when in doubt, follow the money. And that is one of the key problems with the aid industry, if you like, that the majority of the money within the aid industry comes from governments, and that comes with strings attached. As you know, one of my pet hates is that aid agencies call themselves NGOs. One, because to call yourself a non-governmental organization while 70% of your budget actually is government money is maybe a bit contentious, but also I find it a bit odd that you describe yourself by what you're not. It's a bit saying like, what is your job? And you say, I'm not a nurse. You know, it's a bit weird. So I would like that aid agencies actually are just proud of who they are and tell what they are and not what they are not. that would be very helpful in the rhetoric. Now this whole development of aid and security becomes very prominent indeed in the recent wrangling of the European Union, including for the moment the United Kingdom, with what they call the migration crisis, which we have called mostly a self-made crisis, because in itself 1 million people is not beyond the capacity of Europe to absorb, but if you of course put fences around these people, then you make it a crisis. But this is actually becoming quite cynical, and not just from the UK, but from most of the European countries, where a concept that has been lingering for years is the concept of creating safe zones within the country itself. That has been piloted in places like the Democratic Republic of Congo. They called it Islands of Peace. They're piloting this concept now in Afghanistan, where they're designating certain zones in Afghanistan, although to be safe places, so refugees can be returned to those places, if not to the places where there's the war. And it's certainly part of the rhetoric, but now also of the practice, of the negotiations between the EU and Turkey about creating this buffer zone within Syria, which then becomes a safe zone, so that refugees are not only pushed back from Europe to Turkey, but are pushed even further back, which is essentially back into the country that they just fled from. And this is quite explicit now. There's a lot of discussion within the aid budgets, not just of DFID, but also of the European aid, humanitarian agency ECHO, of allocating funds for these so-called grey zones. And that's where you have not only the erosion of international humanitarian law, but that's also where you get a chipping away on what was supposed to be enshrined in the refugee law, which tells people that they have the right to flee their country if there is a conflict. So that is quite something. Now, on Afghanistan. Say the statistics are pretty bad for the security of aid workers. Now, of course, since most aid workers that are counted, that are being hurt, are usually connected to either directly employed or international workers, so there's plenty of them in Afghanistan, and most of them have left Syria, and most of them have left Somalia. So the reason that Afghanistan is very high on the list is probably not so because it's more dangerous than Syria and Somalia, but just because there's much less aid workers than in Syria and Somalia. But the picture it paints that it's becoming more and more dangerous, in terms of pure statistics, is not true. If you look at the last, I think it's about 20 years now, that there has been a systematic counting of aid workers, and if you put it against the number of aid workers in the field, both national and international, it's kind of a flat line. In proportion to the number of aid workers, the number of victims of violence, death or injury or kidnap, in terms of percentage, remains about the same. But it's concentrating in less and less places. And I think that's why it looks more and more dangerous. There are not 20 different conflicts going on this planet. So the majority of those aid workers that get killed, kidnapped, or injured are indeed in Afghanistan, Somalia, Syria, and Sudan. So there's certainly a concentration of danger, if not a real increase of danger. The integrated missions, that is seen by a lot of people as a problem because I think there was an illusion before that the so-called humanitarian agencies of the United Nations, the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, the World Food Programme, etc., were somehow detached from the United Nations and were independent. But what I think that happened with the integrated mission is that at least it made the real situation more honest. In the end, the United Nations is not independent. It's a club of nations. The voting members that tell the United Nations what it can and cannot do are states. And some of those states are obviously more equal than others in the United Nations, so that its aid agencies, in the end, have to take the interests of these states into account. For me, is a given. And integrated missions certainly made it more obvious, but I don't think the fact that UN agencies always have the secondary objective, which is to safeguard the interest of states, has always been there. But whether or not it's helpful that it's so pronounced that now, indeed, people are being explicitly asked to perform humanitarian activities in order to build legitimacy of the state is another matter. But I don't think the integrated mission is the problem. R2P is interesting that you mentioned that, because that somehow died a slow death. A responsibility to protect, that's what it stood for post Rwanda and post Srebrenica, we have to do something. After 10 years of discussions, came to this concept that is legitimate for states to violate sovereignty if civilians are being threatened. I think it didn't only die a death because the global political reality has changed, but also because it was actually used one time and quite explicitly, and that was in Libya 2011. Where this concept of responsibility to protect, to prevent a massacre of the civilians of the city of Benghazi was used to justify a foreign intervention to what was otherwise a sovereign country. And that's certainly, I agree with you, it probably was on its way out, but this was certainly the nail in the coffin for R2P, because I don't think anybody at this stage would argue that this intervention in Libya was a massive success politically, economically, or for that matter for the well-being of the citizens of Libya. Now, finally, I'm not so sure that the fact that the World Humanitarian Summit, no, that's not finally, I will go to my last point is on the principles, but you said the fact that it is not a state-driven process to the World Humanitarian Summit might actually be a good thing, because you have great confidence and probably in the power of civil society, and I don't completely disagree with that. But I think when it comes to humanitarianism, the greatest threat to humanitarianism at this moment actually comes from states that are trying to slowly but surely devalue and chip away at what used to be quite clear international agreements like refugee law and international humanitarian law. So with states having absolutely no commitment to follow anything up, that might be actually more of a weakness in this case than a benefit. Plus, in the end, it is still organized by the United Nations, whose patronage is with states and not with with civil society. But let's wait and see. It's maybe too cynical to think that nothing comes out of it. Now, principles. You put this statement on the board here from Ban Ki-moon's report. What I would say to that is that, although not untrue, one of the reasons MSF is banging on so much about these four principles is because it certainly has proven to us to be a big help in convincing warring parties to let us into their territory and not to shoot at us, although that is being severely challenged in the last 2 years. But to say that this is the only reason these principles are there, I find a bit cynical. Certainly humanity, I think, is for its own sake, but impartiality for me is more than a principle. That is actually also a moral statement. When I am asked to train new generations of country directors on the issue of MSF and principles, I usually pop a bit their bubble. That's according to practice. Neutrality and independence are, in fact, not so much principles. They are more tools that you would need to be able to negotiate access and to remain safe in conflict zones, which means you can also drop them as a hot potato if you're not in a conflict zone or if it's not necessary. But for me, impartiality is really at the heart and the core of the moral imperative of humanitarian action, because impartiality means that you give your insistence based on needs only. And this is exactly what is so blatantly being challenged, for instance, in this recent agreement that was signed between the European Union and Turkey, where they're pledging billions of aid money, 6 billion in total. And the next installment, the next 3 billion, is made conditional to the success of the border control measures that are being put in place. And that really flies in the face of this impartiality. So the aid money now is going to be dispersed not based on which refugee needs it most, but which refugee is furthest away from Europe. And that I find extremely cynical. So yes, the principles are essential to gain access, but I hope that what I see as the probably only core actual moral principle in this list, the impartiality, is more than that. It lies at the heart of what humanitarian action is supposed to be. That's it.
Peter, do you want to respond in any way to some of what Mikhail said, or would you like to go to the audience?
It would be very interesting to hear from the audience, but just a few points in passing. You can perhaps understand why I took particular care while I was researching this book to spend a good deal of time with McKeel, because he knows a great deal and expresses it with vehemence and fluency, and I benefited from that. And he gave us the benefit of his thoughts on NGOs, the merits of the key merit of being something that you are not, or not being something that someone else is, or whatever exactly it was. The other aspect of this, which McKeel himself introduced me to, is that, and this is in relation to Pakistan, where certainly the term NGO is tainted, MSF does not describe itself as an NGO in Pakistan because it's a tainted term, nor for a time did MSF in Pakistan even describe itself as humanitarian for fear of risking more opprobrium in Pakistan, because the term humanitarian has been tainted by the sort of processes that we've been describing here. And one other personal point, because it's a reflection of what McKeel was talking about in relation to localism. And there is localism that can be apparent in all sorts of interesting ways. In East Africa, I was hugely impressed to keep bumping into and going to interview senior aid people dealing with the Somali crisis, who were themselves originally Somali refugees. The head of the Norwegian Refugee Council in Nairobi, Kenya, for the whole of East Africa, is a Somali. The head of UNHCR in Dadaab, which is the huge Somali refugee camp on the Kenyan border, is Somali. The head of Islamic Relief for the whole of that region is an Ethiopian Somali. So what McKeel says about localism in its various forms, I can underline. But let's hear.
Okay, great. Let me remind you to identify yourselves as you're called on to speak, and I'm going to take in groups of three and give you, if that's okay. So take notes, and if you are asking for one or the other of Peter and McKeel, say so, sir.
Good evening. I'm sorry, I'm not a household name in my own household. I'm Benny Dembitzer, and I run a very small charity called Grassroots Africa. I would challenge the two speakers. The greatest humanitarian catastrophe ahead of us is not the Middle East, is Eastern and Southern Africa, where a catastrophe of enormous proportions, because possibly between 30 and 50 million people are running out of food. Now, there the criticism of the NGOs seems to me to be even sharper, because what is required is governments to challenge the international community, to challenge national governments who do bugger all, help their own farmers. They failed in implementing the Maputo resolution under which they said that they would give 10% of their budgets to agriculture. 13 years later, only seven nations have achieved that, and so on. The NGOs, by not challenging the governments, are exacerbating the situation, and this is where we require action, urgent action, now.
Okay. Thank you. Gentleman on the far left. My far left.
Thank you. John, a student. I wonder if you would be able to expand a little bit on what's meant by government, and in terms of the sort of securitization, couldn't you be more specific about where that sort of agency or drive comes from? And is it worth mentioning also areas such as finance and resources in terms of that sort of conflict of, obviously governments are big things, complex things. Is it possible to expand a little bit more on that? Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. And then I'm making you move around a lot. I'm sorry, but the front row in the center, woman in black.
Thank you. My name is Bethany. I was an LSE student last year, and now I work in corporate cybersecurity. I wanted to pick up on the concept of the politicization of aid. Clearly, you both see it as a negative development. But I was wondering whether you see it as harmful enough for the implementation of aid to justify a reduction in government aid budgets.
Okay. Peter, do you want to go first?
No, let McKeel go first.
Okay. All right, in a brief response to the first gentleman, I don't think I ever said that the main humanitarian problem is in the Middle East. It's just some of the key examples from your book were in the Middle East. I'm very much aware of the humanitarian issues in Africa, and so should everybody else actually who is following the so-called migrant crisis, because there are not only Syrians and Afghanis that are fleeing. Now that the Mediterranean season has opened again, weather-wise, and the boats from Algeria, Morocco, Libya, and Egypt start coming into to Italy, you will see a large part of African citizens coming across as well, fleeing indeed, all sorts of things, including famine, water scarcity, poverty, etc. So I'm very well aware of it. In terms of challenging governments, I think we are challenging all governments, and we are we're quite equitable in challenging both Western governments as well as the host governments in doing so. Also, we seem to have a bit difficulty to do that with Turkey at the moment. The politicization of aid is not so much about the aid budgets. It's more, and of course, I would hope that governments will continue to take their responsibility to provide relief to their own citizens as well as citizens of other countries that that are being hit by disaster. I'm also not against the British Army going into Nepal to help with an earthquake or to Sierra Leone to help with Ebola. But what I am against is not so much that there is more financing, but that the objective of the aid is becoming not the need of the person that you're helping, but your own security, because that means it's no longer the most sick, the most vulnerable, the most needy people that you help, but those people that help your political agenda. And I think governments that still call their overseas relief assistance humanitarian aid have an obligation to justify this based on the same humanitarian principles, including impartiality.
Okay. I very much agree with that, because the issue is, or what my book sets out to do, is to try and see these matters from the point of view of the aid agencies, particularly our household name agencies, and their performance under these pressures. I am myself broadly supportive of a substantial government aid program. The question is the terms on which that aid program works its way through in the field, and whether the aid agencies, in accepting government money, which they're of course entitled to do and encouraged to do, whether they are conducting themselves in conformity with the principles that they have historically said they stand by. As I observed in the course of what I said, governments ultimately always conduct their own affairs in their own interests, in their own national interests, as interpreted. But that's not an excuse that an aid agency use, because they should be able to pursue their aid, their own aid efforts, in a principled fashion.
Okay. We go to the gentleman against the far wall there.
Hi, my name's Drew from SOAS. There was a comment earlier that said regarding bombings of hospitals, particularly the one in Afghanistan by the U.S., and other bombings of hospitals and civilian targets, that there was some sort of sense that perhaps it wasn't totally erroneous. Can you describe how you came to that conclusion?
Okay. Ask the woman in the striped sweater in the front.
Hi, my name is Haruka, and I'm a master's student here studying international development and humanitarian emergencies. I have a question about the non-Western donors, or the emergence of so-called new donors. Much attention has been given on the so-called securitization and politicization of aid by Western governments in the context of Afghanistan and Iraq, but not much has been given on the infringement of IHL by non-Western actors, and the future challenge seems to be resting on how we can get those governments involved in the discussion. And my question is, how can we promote dialogue between among those actors, and also, and is the intention of or the willingness of us to be kind of imposing those values, promoting the sort of, I guess, the Western values that's rooted in the humanitarianism. If, I don't know if I'm making any sense, but...
All right. Yeah. The on the aisle, a woman with, yeah, there, the black jacket. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Louise. I work with Christian Aid. And this is, question is in a personal capacity. I'm not speaking on behalf of the organization. But I'm just interested in what the panel think. Can, inverted commas, NGOs at this point claim back any of the impartiality we may have lost through accepting funding from governments. I've worked on Syria for the last almost 2 years, and I think as each day progresses, I think we're seeing more and more of the reality that IHL is being eroded. There is no such thing as independent and principled humanitarian access for agencies anymore, and I think Syria is one of the key cases. And I wonder what the panel think that NGOs like Christian Aid and like all the other NGOs you've spoken about can do to claw back some of that access to populations.
Okay. As far as the response of NGOs to these current crises are concerned, I do feel that that perhaps significant British agencies need to address the acute nature of current emergencies. In the case of Oxfam, which I've followed carefully, there was a deliberate calculation made between 5 and 10 years ago that conflict around the world was declining, and that enabled an agency like Oxfam, by instinct developmental and world-changing from that point of view, to move much more firmly into the development camp. And there's further acknowledgement on Oxfam's part now that that was an unfortunate set of decisions to take. It may have been backed by figures on what was happening to conflict, but the reality has turned out differently. And I feel, willy-nilly, that our major aid NGOs are going to need to consider more firmly than they are doing at present a more decisive shift into the emergency field. And as soon as they do that, it will be essential that they examine their approach and their conduct in relation to these fundamental principles. Because the truth is that you can't do your job very well in these difficult conflicts where your own government is engaged if you are not prepared to show a measure of independence from them. And could I just say to the questioner over here, I deliberately did not suggest that that was a deliberate attack on Kunduz, and Mikhail knows this story infinitely better than I do. The truth is that what should have happened, perhaps, is a rather more rigorous, possibly international, inquiry into what went wrong, which is what MSF itself has been demanding now for months, and we've yet to see it. One thing I would look out for, perhaps, in the weeks before the World Humanitarian Summit, is whether the Americans finally do get round to revealing a little more of the detail of that particular incident. We know that the United States will not accept an international inquiry because the United States never does acknowledge or accept such inquiries, particularly in a wholly sensitive area like this. But it would help, and presumably MSF would acknowledge that it would help, if a good deal more detail on what went wrong was put into the public domain.
Yeah, okay, but maybe on this one I should specify a bit, because, like I said, the most extreme example, because it had the greatest level of destruction and death, was the hospital in Kunduz, but it's just one of 12 or 14 MSF hospitals, so the ones that we were running. So we have the most detailed information about that have been bombed over the last 2 years. And of course, publicly, nobody is saying we bombed it on purpose. The usual public discourse is, hey, you bombed us. No, we didn't. Yes, you did. Okay, it was a mistake. And then fog of war or collateral damage or something like that. But we don't discuss with these governments just via the press, obviously. So after these incidents, we do have discussions on all levels, in the case of Kunduz in Washington, in the case of Yemen in Riyadh, in etc., etc. And when you get into the discussions with the actual military and the officials, we are always being questioned on how neutral our facility was and whether or not it was being used as a terrorist base. And then when we ask clarifications on what does that mean, if there's a patient inside that was an ex-combatant, does that mean it's a terrorist base? Or if this patient makes a phone call, does that mean it's being used as a command and control center? We don't get clear answers. So then we have to say the only rules we know are the international humanitarian law, which clearly states a combatant that is wounded becomes an ex-combatant and has the same protection as a civilian. If there's new rules, then we need to know about it, because these new rules are all in what they call rules of engagement under their own anti-terrorism laws, which are usually secret. So that's where we got into trouble. So we don't know anymore, because you don't want to tell us what is it that defines or makes a hospital lose its protected status. Is it when you allow patients to come in at all that used to be combatants? Is it when they start making phone calls? Is it when is it? And that's why I say it's not so clear-cut in those conversations, and there's certainly an attempt to chip away at the protected state of hospitals. Because the United States, with all the other big powers, Russia or China, are the same. They almost never sign international agreements. They don't sign the ICC, they don't sign the ban on landmines. Almost the only thing they've actually signed and probably regret now is the 1948 international humanitarian law. And probably if it was introduced now, these big states would also refuse to sign that at this stage. So it's essentially the only thing we've got, essentially, especially against those big powers, which is these P5 governments, very few of which have signed anything since. On the non-Western donors, that's an interesting question, because what you have, of course, Qatar and the Emirates are huge donors now in Syria and in Yemen. Turkey by itself is becoming a bit big, both aid implementer and aid donor in places like Somalia or Mali or Central Africa. And by and large, what we see is that they do exactly the same as what Western donors do, that they put national interest and security interest central to their aid efforts. So the only thing I can say about that, I don't think one is worse than the other, that these so-called new donors at least didn't pretend for 30 years that they were impartial and neutral. So that is maybe the only difference that I can see. Finally, we never answered the question of that gentleman there, what is a government? I had a bit of a think about it. It's a government is, of course, a very contemporary concept where the world is defined on a system of sovereignty, and each sovereign state defined by its monopoly of power, in a sense, that only governments are allowed to have official violence in the form of police and armies. The flip side of that is that, to quote Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility. that it also gives you an obligation then to take care of your own citizens and whatever citizens might find themselves on your territory. So a government for me is a very specific and well-defined entity, which is different from aid agencies or any kind of groupings, because they have the monopoly of power. They have a greater than most responsibility that comes with that. And that's what we are challenging in some of these politicization debates.
Okay, and unfortunately, I know you've been asking, we've run out of time, so we end on that note, I'm afraid, unless there's a compelling last word you want to have, Peter.
No, I don't think so.
Please join me in thanking Peter Gill and Mikkel Hoff.